This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, we head to Kiribati, where plans are underway to lift up its islands. Billions of dollars and tons of sand and stone are needed, but some say there are few alternatives.
In the light of what is coming with the projected rise in sea level and the greater impacts of climate change, we would have to undertake very radical adaptation measures.
Also ahead, in PNG, the country's national domestic violence hotline is overwhelmed by calls from an unlikely source, men.
There are those who have harmed a woman or their partner or wife, and they're remorseful and they want to change.
And we find out why experts believe an end to the world's plastic addiction might be closer than you think. All that and more coming up. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, a ransomware attack on Vanuatu's government is still crippling public services, almost a month since the hack was first identified. Government emails, websites and internal servers are paralyzed. In some cases, workers can't be paid since payroll is down and goods aren't being delivered. Australia is offering support, but it's unclear when services will get back online, as Dubrovka Volodare reports.
At Vanuatu's main hospital, Port Vila Central, they're feeling the impact of the cyber attack. Dr. Vincent Atua is medical superintendent.
Well, just going back to how we used to do things in the olden days, it does slow things down a lot, as in communicating between wards. So when the hack started, the one that really affected us was the telephones. So calling between wards, transferring patients back and forth, so communication within the ward. But once that was sorted out, things have slowly come back to normal.
While it's not impacting on patient care, he says it's still affecting the hospital and its staff.
One thing that's still frustrating us is getting payments for our suppliers, because our finance and procurement system depends on the internet. And so that's been a major, major issue.
And that means using pen and paper or walking to other departments to get things done.
For example, if we run out of soap or laundry, in order to get payment for it, it has to go through some financial process that then allows us to raise purchase orders. That's been crippled or paralyzed, and so we have to do things manually, and it means traveling from here down to finance and back, or getting urgently required drugs, raising payments for that by going through the finance system is awfully slow, and many times we have had delays.
There have been reports that salaries of some government employees have been affected, but Dr. Atua says hospital staff are still getting paid.
Finance worked out a way to keep the salaries running, but the base salary. So sometimes people are entitled for things like overtime. Those allowances have been put on hold.
The cyber attack has also caused delays in the shipping of goods. But one of its main effects has been the disruption throughout the civil service itself.
So all government systems are still down. They've been down since we came into government, basically. We came into government and less than 24 hours later, this cyber attack took the whole government system down, and it's still down now. So yes, it's affecting our work.
Ralph Reginvanu is Vanuatu's new climate change minister.
We've put in place the necessary decisions and so on to get it fixed, and the people are working on it. But it's a serious breach of our national security.
Australian experts are helping Vanuatu to rebuild its IT network with the aim to future-proof it.
We're very concerned about the fact that it happened, and we're very concerned about how we fix it, given what's happening in the world today, not only in terms of technology and cyber matters, but also in terms of geopolitics. So it's very concerning to us how we reboot in a way that is going to be good for our future long-term security.
Australia's Pacific Minister, Pat Conroy, who was in Vanuatu last week, says cyber attacks were a problem for many countries in the region.
The really important thing is, in this age, governments and organisations and businesses are under constant scrutiny from malicious actors. And it's very important that the Pacific family works together to make sure that all our systems work properly. And when a system does go down, that members of the Pacific family are there to help.
It's still unclear who's behind the attack. Dr. Matt Keane from the think tank the Lowy Institute says there could be a couple of reasons why Vanuatu was targeted.
One is financial, and that was, you recall, the PNG cyber attack on their financial management system last year, and that was clearly financial motivation, a motivation for ransom and information that could be leveraged for financial advantage. That's a possibility here, but it has disabled the government system, so the other possibility is some sort of political motivation.
Dr. Keane says Vanuatu plays an important role in the region.
It has important roles to play with geopolitics, its role within the PIF. It has relations, obviously, with Australia, with the US, but also with China. It is one of the non-aligned countries of the Pacific. It has a strong policy of being friends to all, and it takes strong stances geopolitically on certain issues. And we've seen that on climate change, we've seen that on West Papua and a number of other issues.
Dr. McKean says Vanuatu's situation is something other Pacific countries should be wary of.
There is obviously a clear need to strengthen these cyber systems, these internet systems, and I think there is a role for regional agencies to help in that process.
Back at Port Vila Central, Dr. Vincent Atua says there's some silver lining to the hack.
It does make us rethink about our business plans for the next few years to make sure that we ensure there's a backup system for the hospital itself.
It's unclear when Vanuatu's service will be up and running again, but there is hope they will be fixed in the coming weeks.
That was Dubrovka Volodar with that report. You're listening to Pacific Beat. Hope you're having a lovely Monday morning. The threat of rising sea levels has led Kiribati to float a unique idea to save its land, raise the islands by up to 5 metres. It could cost billions of dollars and involves digging up tons of sand and rock. President Tanes Mamo is asking for the international community to help raise funds. So how could the idea work? Mackenzie Smith takes a look.
Rising tides have led to ambitious plans in Kiribati, among them a series of artificial floating islands and mass migration to Australia or Fiji. But now the government is turning its focus to saying, provided it can raise the atolls some 3 to 5 metres. Former President Anote Tong, who has backed the idea for years, says it may be the country's only hope of keeping its sovereignty.
In the light of what is coming with the projected rise in sea level and the greater impacts of climate change, we would have to undertake very radical adaptation measures.
Research on the effectiveness of building up islands is limited, but Francois Flocard, Principal Engineer for Coastal Engineering at the UNSW's Water Research Laboratory, thinks the government's plan holds water. He's worked in coastal resilience in the Cook Islands and the Marshall Islands. Based on those experiences, he says how Kiribati sources its materials, usually a mixture of sand with an outer layer made of rock, concrete or metal, will make all the difference. For example, taking sand from the atolls themselves could destabilize the area and heighten the risks of flooding.
If you're taking the sand off the beach to build your protection, you are creating a situation where you potentially making things worse in the long term.
In Kiribati, work has already started on coastal resilience. President Tanes Mamo told The Guardian rocks from Fiji have been imported to strengthen seawalls. Mr. Flockhart says with the impacts of global warming becoming more apparent, there's been an uptick in regional interest in similar developments in the Pacific. But whether they work is another matter. Mr. Flockhart says frequent cyclones could prove a serious challenge to any build-ups of land, and erosion by waves and storms aren't the only threat being brought in with each high tide.
Sea level rise also will have other impacts which you may be familiar with, such as the increased salinity of the groundwater and the freshwater resource. So, you know, raising the land is addressing a certain problem associated with sea level rise, but sea level rise will also have a compounding effect, for example, on your on your freshwater supply.
Others are less optimistic. Bart Van Buren is founder of urban planning firm Water Architect. He says raising islands would have a devastating impact on Kiribati, which might make the country unrecognizable to its people.
We're definitely talking about to make it into a fortress. It would involve tons of concrete or other hard materials. And, well, ironically, making it a fortress would be maybe in the interest of a few powers around, but not for the nation itself, I'm sure.
He's concerned dredging could also create an ecological disaster if it isn't handled carefully.
What will happen with the surroundings? I reckon this would also destroy all the corals around it, including the fish habitats where, well, that's basically the economy there, right?
Mr. Van Buren was an early proponent of floating cities, an idea to build artificial structures that could move around at sea and rehome Pacific communities. He still thinks it's a better option than building up existing atolls, but he says there are nature-based solutions that are effective too, like mangroves and oyster walls.
It's hard to say if that can fight the rise of the sea fast enough that it will be sufficient protection, but it's a great soft measure approach, which is probably less expensive and less harm to the fishery and nature.
He says they could also be used in tandem with innovative architecture, such as gradually moving homes onto stilts. But Anote Tong says time is running out and building up the islands is the only way.
Quite frankly, we don't have many more options. We have to destroy things in order to simply stay above the rising seas. And I'm afraid that, in this instance, I think we've gone way out of control and we are going through an unprecedented set of circumstances.
Mr. Tong says even if they build up the islands, some people in Kiribati may not want to stay. But he says they owe it to future generations to provide the option for those that do.
That was Mackenzie Smith with that report. And now that sound means, well, you all know what that means. It's time here on Pacific Beat to find out what's making news around the region. And to do that, I'm joined by Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Priyanka.
Did you have a good weekend?
I did. I got mortally sunburned, actually.
Oh, really?
And what felt like the first day this summer that the sun actually came out in Victoria. shoulders are a bit red, but no, had a great weekend. What about yourself?
Yeah, not bad. I mean, it was nice to see the sun out. Yes, for those of you not in Victoria, we've had just the most awful start to, well, yes, summer or the spring and, yeah, just been raining and grey. And finally, we got a bit of sunshine. Which was nice. So I just enjoyed it. Went to the beach and enjoy it while it lasts, I guess. But I know a lot of people in the Pacific probably don't have the same experience as us with the beautiful weather there. But I'm trying to weave this into this story about fishing regulations. Perhaps some sailors aboard their ships don't have the finest weather, but they might have some finer times aboard their ships with regulations about to tighten, particularly are aboard commercial fishing vessels. Or what's going on? Why is this happening?
Yeah, so it's a bit of interesting, this one. So we could soon see regional fisheries observers return to the decks of commercial fishing ships as early as next year. So this is reported by RNZ. And basically, for a bit of background, observers are independent witnesses who spend weeks aboard some of these major vessels. And they collect things like data that sort of takes into account the types of fish being caught, the measures which are used to catch them, and if there are any breaches as fishermen sort of go about those things. However, they haven't been used for about 3 years now. The Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission suspended that program at the start of the pandemic. So a lot of these vessels in the time since have just gone unregulated.
Oh, very interesting. There is a lot of concern, particularly around those observers. I don't know if you know, Kyle, but a lot of them actually go missing because it's unclear why. And a lot of them are in the Pacific. I believe the last count was just under a dozen or so Pacific fisheries observers have gone missing, and it's a worldwide problem. There are other regions as well.
I didn't know that. When you say go missing, as in they hop on the boat and they don't come back on the boat.
They don't come back, yeah,
oh,
pretty much. There are some concerns that they may have been, you know, allegedly killed if they do notice something unregulated happening. A lot of people call these ships sort of evading the law. They sort of exist out in the open sea and people aren't sure what happens. But yeah, there are some. I think the most recent one was a fishing observer in Kiribati who went missing. This was a couple of years ago. I remember speaking to his family, who was still looking for answers and perhaps to this day are still trying to find out what happened and the results of investigations. So yes, it can be quite concerning. Sometimes the bodies do turn up eventually, sometimes they don't. So yeah, interesting to see with this restart of the program if some of the regulations for the observers themselves might be tightened. There were talks of having like security cameras aboard these boats or, you know, using drones perhaps to support the observers so you're not putting lives at risk necessarily. I mean, it is a low percentage of observers, but, you know, these people are sort of putting their lives out there to regulate the fish that come to us. So, yeah, they should be safe.
Yeah, well, look, according to report, they're obviously, you know, necessary. It has been quite detrimental in some cases not having them there. Obviously, they enforce a lot of these conservation rules to protect fish, turtles, marine life and things like that.
Important stuff.
And without them there, you know, it's you know, those rules aren't really enforced, are they? So
yes, exactly. So it is necessary to have them there, as you mentioned, but yeah, also necessary to protect them, perhaps. We need observers for our observers. Now, actually, coming up on the show, Carl, we'll have a story about domestic violence in Papua New Guinea and a hotline there and looking at some of the challenges they have. They're overwhelmed, apparently, from calls. But now let's head to Samoa because the victim support group there has released its figures for 2022. How are they faring?
Yeah, that's right. So this is the country's youth crisis support group, and they've released their figures for 2022. And they've had a pretty busy year in some ways. So 45 children and 32 teenagers have contacted the NGO this year for help and more expected as the year rounds up. So there's not a lot of context provided in the report sort of compared to years past and things like that. It's reported by the Samoa Observer. But during that time, there were 23 cases of physical abuse, 18 cases of sexual abuse, and 13 cases where kids were either threatened or harassed. Of the 32 teenagers, 18 were males and 14 were females. So, yeah, pretty even split there. The most common problem among males actually was a lot of misbehaviour, things like petty crime and theft and things like that, whereas with the girls it was sort of more internal. Tragically, this is probably what stuck out to me the most. Pretty much all these calls, or most of them, most of these calls for help actually came at school because they weren't actually able to make them outside of school because a lot of these issues, you know, things like bullying and the abuse actually happens at home and school's the one place where they feel safe to actually reach out for help.
Oh, that is a shame. Yes, it's hard to know if those figures are rising or not, but, you know, any child who, I guess, sees the need to reach out, It is a tragedy, but good thing that support group is there to support them.
It's good to shed light this time of year as well with Christmas coming up, Indeed. Which unfortunately every year those figures do tend to rise.
Yes, that's very true. And as I mentioned, we've got a story on domestic violence in Papua New Guinea and its hotline coming up. And now to some sporting news. A familiar face has been appointed the new head coach of the Papua New Guinea Hunters. Who is that?
That's right. It's a friend of the show, actually, Stanley Tepend, who's been on Pacific Beat a number of times.
Indeed.
He is being confirmed as the coach for the 2023 QRL season. He's known for much more than being on Pacific Beat, though, let me assure you. So he's actually the current Kumuls coach, fresh off a World Cup campaign. He was also the former assistant coach of the PNG Hunters as well. So he's going to replace former head coach Matt Church, who took that job in Brisbane earlier this year, which we reported on. And yeah, look, like I mentioned, Tepend, a very highly decorated coach. He's done pretty much pretty much everything in the PNG coaching world. He's coached the Digicel Cup in the past as well, and I'm sure he'll be a great addition to the Hunters program.
Highly decorated. I mean, I'm sure his highest decoration is being on Pacific Beat and speaking to Richard Hewitt and you on our sports show that goes to air every Fridays. I'm sure that put him across the line to become coach. So do we know when preparations will get underway for next season?
Yeah, so they've already started. So they actually, over the weekend, named a 39-man training squad. They were named on Saturday, and they'll begin preparations for the new season next week. And it'll be a good season for the Hunters in a lot of ways. Just the fact that they'll be able to play regular home games again will be fantastic for them. So I expect them to be do a little bit better in terms of wins and losses.
Yes, we'll see what happens. Thank you, Kyle, for those stories.
Thank you, Priyanka.
Kyle Evans, and bringing us the latest from around the region. And don't go anywhere. I mentioned about that story on Papua New Guinea's National Domestic Violence Helpline that's coming up. A very curious aspect of that helpline getting overwhelmed is that it's actually men who are making the most number of calls. We'll find out why just coming up. And also, we'll take a look at the plastics treaty. Representatives from countries around the world are meeting this week to discuss the plastics treaty. It's supposed to end our addiction to plastic. We'll find out what exactly the treaty is about coming up in about 10 or so minutes. And also, this is a story that a lot of Pacific Island countries might find a strike a chord with. It's the history of Christmas Island off the coast of both Australia and Indonesia. In early years of the 20th century, Chinese workers were brought there to mine phosphate. Again, I said it was very similar to a lot of Pacific Islands. So workers were brought there to mine this phosphate, but some of them ended up being stuck there. We'll take a bit of a history lesson coming up on the show to find out exactly what happened on Christmas Island.
Join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
When you're younger, you don't really take note of the significance of this ritual until you're much older. Then you realize that you're proud to be part of this ritual.
So join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk. Wednesdays at 3:30 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Hope you're having a wonderful Monday morning. I certainly am, despite my mumbling my words. Now, let's head to Papua New Guinea, where the country's only national domestic violence helpline says it's overwhelmed by the number of calls it's receiving on a daily basis. And unexpectedly, counsellors say the majority of calls they receive are from men, some of whom are perpetrators of domestic abuse. Marion Farr with this report.
It's a typical busy afternoon at Papua New Guinea's only domestic violence hotline.
Hello, you are calling Wanto Counseling Helping Line. This is a free...
Counsellor Lorna Nikiri is taking calls from people seeking help with abusive relationships.
The positive of working in this space is just having that satisfaction of helping someone.
It's rewarding work, but the Wanto Counseling Helping Line is struggling to keep up with the number of calls coming through. Papua New Guinea has one of the highest rates of domestic violence in the world.
The number of calls has increased, and on a daily basis we get more callers and it stresses us.
Despite being a service mainly for women and children, Ms. Nikiri says the majority of callers are actually men.
I would say that that's because most men own mobile phones and not women.
She says many are witnesses to domestic violence who want information on how to help victims in their communities. But sometimes perpetrators of abuse phone the helpline too.
There are those who have harmed a woman or their partner or wives, and they're remorseful and they want to change. So those are the ones that calling for help.
Ms. Nikiri says some men want to challenge the laws protecting women or even shift the blame for violence onto their female partners. It's something helpline manager Kinema Daniel has noticed too. But she sees this as an opportunity.
We see this as an important avenue where we can provide that support that is needed for the men.
Ms. Daniel believes more education and awareness is crucial.
It is really important for us at the helpline to provide the information that is needed for the men who are calling the helpline to understand the laws, the regulations, the processes, and also they can be able to provide that support for their women and children.
As a survivor of domestic violence herself, Ms. Daniel knows how important the service is. When she was suffering abuse at the hands of her husband, there was nowhere to turn for help.
Even you go to your family and your family is not supportive, I have to go through very brutal abuse. Like every day you have black eye, every day you get to be beaten up.
Ms. Daniel is proud to support victims, but she says more on-the-ground services are desperately needed.
Even the police and everyone need the support to work together. And I have a survivor I want to refer to the police, but that police is only one person and he's already gone for a meeting or he's attending to another client. Then my client is not saved.
Child Fund Australia CEO Margaret Sheehan heads the organisation that funds the helpline. She's calling on the Papua New Guinean government to take more action on the issue, including funding the One Talk Council and Helping Line.
Access to services like safe houses for women, more counsellors, social workers, training for healthcare workers, training for emergency services.
Earlier this year, a special parliamentary committee on gender-based violence made 71 recommendations to the PNG government.
There's been no clarity about where these recommendations have been put in place. So, in a way, we call on the government to try and identify what the next steps are, exactly what they're going to do.
She says addressing the issue couldn't be more urgent.
That was Marion Farr with that report. And if you or anyone you know is experiencing domestic violence in Papua New Guinea, you can call that One Talk Council and Help Him line for free on Digicel by dialing 7150800. And for more about gender-based violence in Papua New Guinea, reporter Marion Farr spoke to Port Moresby Governor Powers Parkop. He's chair of a new parliamentary committee tasked with ensuring women's empowerment and combating domestic abuse. And he says he's determined to address the issue.
It's different to the committee that we had in the last parliament, which was a special parliamentary committee on GBV. That was a temporary committee. Now the motion and the resolution of Parliament is to create a permanent parliamentary committee that can have oversight on this very important human rights and development issue, which is gender equality, women's empowerment and gender-based violence.
Now, Governor, the previous parliamentary committee delivered 71 recommendations to, I guess, address the issue of gender-based violence in Papua New Guinea, which is an extremely serious and widespread issue. One of the services in Papua New Guinea is the One Talk Council and Help Him line. And the managers of that service are asking the government for more clarity on how it is going to implement those recommendations, those 71 recommendations. Can you give us some clarity about that? What is the government actually going to do and take action on?
The first initiative that is most important and critical to the work of addressing gender-based violence, bridging the gap and achieving gender equality is to set up the secretariat that is going to design and develop the program, implement the strategy, coordinate national action, provincial action, and local level action in order that we can reduce or eliminate gender-based violence. So that's the important thing that should take place. Secondly, in the government funding, like for this year, $7 million was allocated. Part of the funds are also designated for NGOs, civil society, faith-based organizations who have been working in that space. And there are a lot of organizations, including the one that you have mentioned, that are doing a wonderful work, but they've virtually little or no government support. For the first time, we have got a national government to allocate these funds, which is 7 million. I'm not sure how that is working out, because it now comes to implementation. It has to go to the department that is as a mandate and portfolio over these agendas. For now, it's the Department for Community Development. I'm hoping to, and I've been advised that we might get more funding for next year. So the job of our committee is to have oversight. Our committee is not to implement. We have oversight, meaning that we will hold all the government department, provincial government, national government, different agencies of the state to account.
Governor, you mentioned that the first initiative in implementing some of the recommendations delivered by the previous parliamentary committee was to set up the secretariat to yes. coordinate the initiatives. What's the timeline for that?
This is another sort of a matter that our committee that has been set up yesterday will be having oversight. We want all these respective agencies, especially the Department for Community Development, if they still host the secretariat, to give us a timeline, or otherwise we will give them a timeline and we will hold them to account. So these are the immediate things that our committee will be inquiring into. So we're going to make sure things happen.
And Governor, are there any women on this committee?
Yes, there is Governor for Central, Honourable Rufina Pita. Our other female member of Parliament, Honourable Cassie Sawang, she qualifies and was available to be a member of the committee, but she's a vice minister, so the rules of the parliament would not allow her to become a member of the committee. Yeah.
Finally, Governor, and just briefly, what makes you so passionate about this issue?
For me, like, my background was in human rights and in law generally, so that's my profession. I worked in this space for a long time before I came to parliament, so, you know, it's a continuation of my life. But also, from where I'm from, originally from Manus, we have a lot of respect and a role for women, positive role, powerful roles that achieves a lot of outcome for us in our tribal setting.
That was Port Moresby Governor Pauls Pakop speaking there with reporter Marion Farr. You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Priyanka Srinivasan. This week, scientists, environmentalists and representatives from countries around the world will take the first step in a long process to end the world's addiction to plastic. They're meeting to negotiate a treaty to end plastic pollution. It's being called Paris for Plastics. And while Australia is already arguing for a legally binding global set of rules to end plastic pollution, efforts here are lagging. ABC's Jill Bennett has the story.
The Cooks River snakes through the heavily industrialised and heavily populated southwestern suburbs of Sydney into Botany Bay. It's often called Australia's dirtiest river. Peter Munro spends his spare time working with a volunteer cleanup group called the Mud Crabs. Over two decades, he's seen and collected hundreds of kilograms of plastic rubbish carried along the waterway.
The little fish things that the soy sauce comes in for sushi, hundreds and hundreds of them. Literally, there were thousands and thousands of plastic bottles coming in with their lids on that floated. So there were literally carpets of plastic bottles. You know, literally, there were places in the river that you could almost walk across. The litter was so thick.
Peter Munro is expecting to find more plastic bags in the mangrove swamps that line the river now that soft plastic recycling scheme RedCycle has collapsed.
The main plastic litter now is plastic bags, bubble wrap, a range of, you know, things that have been wrapped in plastic. You can see here in the mangroves where we're standing now, low tide, you'll see plastic bags hanging from those as the tide goes out and the mangrove base is exposed.
Australians are the second highest consumers of single-use plastics in the world after Singapore. Overall, most plastic still ends up in landfill. Just 13% is recycled. And up to 140,000 tonnes each year is what's called leakage. It ends up in the environment as plastic pollution. Worldwide, the UN estimates we're already generating around 400 million tonnes of plastic waste every year, and that's expected to double in the next 20 years.
So the current agreement going into these negotiations is to negotiate a global agreement that could include binding, so that means legally binding, and non-binding, which means voluntary, measures to end plastic pollution.
WWF plastics campaigner Kate Noble will be at the UN meeting in Uruguay.
But also to look at plastic production and ensure that it's sustainable right from the time that fossil fuels are extracted from the ground through to design, how we design products, how we reuse them, how we reduce the amount of plastic that we use, and then what we do with it at the end of life. So the instrument at the moment is aimed at tackling plastics right through what we call the life cycle.
Australia has already signed up to what's called the High Ambition Coalition. That's countries that support legally binding global rules to reduce plastic pollution. But some of the world's largest producers and consumers of plastics, including the United States and some of the oil-producing countries, want voluntary targets. Kate Noble again.
There are many countries and scientists and environmental organisations that are arguing that this treaty will only impact effectively on the plastic pollution crisis if it includes global rules. And those global rules, for example, could include things like a ban on difficult to recycle plastics, labelling requirements and standards, bans on certain products. But that is all up for negotiation. There are a lot of multinational businesses that see these kind of global rules as an important component of the treaty, because at the moment they're dealing with so many different regulatory frameworks and their compliance costs are really, really high.
Australia has a 2025 deadline to dramatically reduce the amount of plastic packaging used here. The goals are ambitious. 100% reusable, recyclable or compostable packaging to be in use, 70% of packaging to be recycled or composted, and all packaging to include 50% recycled content. But we're falling far short of meeting some of those targets.
Supply chains, COVID, we've actually had an increase in capacity in the system to recycle, but we've also had a greater increase in the volume of plastic packaging entering the market.
Chris Foley is the chief executive of APCO, the Australian Packaging Covenant Organisation. He says there are challenges along the recycling supply chain.
What we're finding is that there is certainly a loss of recyclable materials just through poor source separation at a household and business level. We've also got technical and commercial barriers to sorting within material recovery facilities. The infrastructure across the country is not all equal, and some of that infrastructure and equipment is old and could be updated to improve volumes and accuracy of sorting and the automation of sorting. We've also got some challenges with limited end markets for some of the plastic materials coming through. And there's obviously in the background, we've also got inconsistent state definitions and policies.
Despite the increase in plastics and problems with recycling, Chris Foley says Australia can get on top of plastic pollution.
But we also know that there's the biggest pipeline of investment coming into the recycling industry, or the reprocessing industry that Australia's ever seen for plastic. So within 2 to 3 years, by 2025, we're expecting a significant increase in the capacity of Australia to actually reprocess.
Back on the banks of the Cooks River, Peter Munro's not optimistic he'll see the end of plastic rubbish anytime soon.
But just in this small couple of square metres, I can see some plastic straws, I can see a plastic bag lying just there, I can see little bits of fruit bottle tops. I don't think we've progressed anywhere in terms of reducing the amount of plastic that's produced. I think it's gone 10 times worse than when we first started. So I think it is a losing battle. I think it needs to be a dramatic change in circular economy so that people that are producing these things are responsible for them for their whole of life.
That's Cook's River Mud Crab, Peter Munro, ending that report by Julian Bennett. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning here on Pacific Beat. I've got a story for you that has parallels with many Pacific islands. In the early years of the 20th century, thousands of Chinese workers crossed the seas to Christmas Island, which is near Indonesia and off the northwest coast of Australia. It was rich in phosphate, and when a British mining company set up on the island, it needed workers. They came to seek their fortune, but instead struck tragedy. The full story is in the History Listen doco. Here's an excerpt from it.
Over those first 7 years of phosphate mining on Christmas Island, 2,500 Chinese workers came to seek their fortune. And shockingly, a quarter of them died of beriberi, a disease of the nervous system that no one understood at the time.
Basically, they died of a slow paralysis and they were conscious right up till the very end.
Fran Yeo is a former Christmas Islander who runs the Christmas Island Archives website.
It took about 30 days for them to die.
So enormous numbers of the workforce dying and no one understands why.
No. There were clues. There were all sorts of theories as to why they had beriberi. They thought it could have been microbes in the soil giving off gas. There was some sort of a contagion or a bacterial infection. With the diet, they thought it could be a deficiency of fat or nitrogenous starvation or phosphorus deficiency or infected fish. From April 1901, for the rest of that year, there were 680 admissions to the hospital, and of those, 229 men died of beriberi. I think this would have been a huge concern for the mining company. Half their workforce is dying. It's not a good look.
Indeed it wasn't, but the company was making enormous profits. Between 1900 and 1904, they made $14 million in today's terms. Christmas Island was a long way from anywhere, and it was easy for the company to ignore the devastating death toll among its workers and merely replace them with more from China. But then, a visit from the British colonial government representative, Lewis Hare Clayton, was followed by his scathing report.
Recommendations by Clayton back to the Singapore government meant a stop to coolie migration.
It wasn't only beriberi, of course, it was the accidents and the primitive form of mining that was going on. You've got photos also of some of those incredible scenes in the phosphate mine.
You notice that those poor men that were labouring, it was all by hand. It appears that they were loading the phosphate rock into, it looks like, wicker baskets. Their clothes look tatty. They've hardly got any foot covering. They may or may not be wearing hats. It would be incredibly hot.
It's been our pleasure looking after you.
I've come to Christmas Island to see for myself what traces this colonial horror story has left on a place where the population is two-thirds Chinese.
My name is Patrick Chan. I live on the island for over 40 years and I work currently as a miner on Christmas Island.
Can you imagine this whole road is lined with huts on stilts, wooden huts on stilts, and, you know, it's muddy.
Patrick Chan and I are heading along the coast road to one of the two Chinese cemeteries on the island. This one, Settlement Cemetery, sits across from the sea against a mountainous jungle backdrop, and it's home to a mob of Christmas Island feral chickens.
This is where the main settlement is. Okay, that's where all the coolies, all the workers, they were staying. So along these graves are those miners who passed away. As with all Chinese grave designs, there is an arc, so like a gate, symbolising that, you know, this is a Chinese cemetery.
How special is it to have a cemetery like this?
Very, very special, because when you think about it, these miners here came in as indentured labour. They probably didn't know that they signed their life away as slaves, okay? So in a way, they work with a false pretense that they are building a future for their family. Okay, but then again, a lot of them do not ever go back to China.
What an fascinating story there. That story was produced by Annie Hastwell, who's uncovering the little-known story of Christmas Island's past. Fascinating stuff. And that was just an excerpt there. If you want to hear all of it, the podcast is called No Way Back. You can check it out at the History Lesson. That's on the ABC Listen app. News is next. And do stick around for some more great programming here on ABC Radio Australia.